This is Billy Kay, welcoming you to The Scots Tongue, an archive series on the history of the lead that I wrote back in 1986. Attitudes have changed a lot since then, and most of the presentation back then, for example, was done in English, whereas now I would do it in Scots. In my book, Scots a Mother Tongue, first published in the same year, I described speaking Scots as an activity engaged in by consenting adults in the privacy of their own home. But now, more and more native speakers have come out the hoose, say to speak, are vaunty about being bilingual and sing it aloud their Scots speakers and their prude. The readers are Peter Raffin and John Shedden. Programme 2 focuses on the dialect of Fife and is cried Makers to Miners. In the first programme, I spoke about how Anglian settlers established the language we now call Scots in the Borders, way back in the 7th century. Today I'll show how Scots replaced Gaelic as the official language of the court and eventually became the dominant speech of the whole of Lowland Scotland. Curiously, the changeover from Gaelic to Scots had a lot to do with the Norman invasion of England and the enormous prestige of the Anglo-Norman culture that flourished there. David I, King of Scots, had a Gaelic-speaking father in Malcolm Canmore and an English mother in Queen Margaret, but the main thrust of his reign was to bring the benefits of the Anglo-Norman culture of the south to Scotland, a policy aided by the granting of Scottish lands to Norman noble families then based in England. This was in the 12th century. By the time of the Wars of Independence in the 14th century, the Normans on this side of the border were thoroughly Scottish in outlook. Robert the Bruce was one of them, and this is the poet John Barbour setting the scene for Bruce's great victory at Bannockburn.
Good king, for uten mar delay, to morn I'll soon as ye say die, or dine your hall for the battle, for duct of dead we sall nocht fail. Nan pine sall refuse it be, till we have mad our country free. Ah, freedom is a noble thing. Freedom ma's man to half leaking. Freedom all solace to man gives. He leaves at S that freely leaves. A noble heart, my half nanes, na ellis noch that my him place, give freedom fail ye.
The strong feeling of national identity expressed in that poem written in the 14th century had evolved in a people who originally came from very different ethnic and linguistic backgrounds. For example, when David I founded royal boroughs all over the lowlands as centres of royal power, they were inhabited by Gaels, Flemish, French and English. The Norman French spoken by the nobility left its mark. Most of the old boroughs have street names like Edinburgh's West Port, from La Porte, the gate, or Avenel, from La Venelle, a lane. But far more important to the development of Scots than the Norman nobility were the thousands of ordinary people from the north of England who accompanied them. Artisans who established themselves in the melting pot of the boroughs and eventually established their dialect as the lingua franca, or everyday speech there. This is what we now call early Scots.
Until the end of the 14th century, Scots and Northern English, Scots and Northern English, not General English, were pretty alike. Mm-hmm. They weren't as alike as people sometimes say. Actually, there were differences. For instance, Scots had already absorbed a lot of Gaelic words, and there were some differences in pronunciation, but broadly they were alike. But again, a divergence set in, and this took place mainly, I think, in the course of the 15th century, which happened to be a time of a kind of spurt of language change in both England and Scotland. Mm-hmm. So there were changes to be made in pronunciation, and of course this was the coming of the Renaissance and a big outburst of new vocabulary. So there were possible changes in the handling and the selection of new vocabulary. And this was all going on in the absence of a kind of standardising pull from the south. So mm-hmm. that Scots and English diverged most of all, I think, in the course of the 15th century. This was the great divide, so to speak.
Jack Aitken of the Dictionary of the Older Scottish Tongue. Much of what we now think of as typically Scots language actually came from what you might call an Anglo-Danish legacy. For those early settlers in the boroughs had originally come from the Danelaw north of the Humber, where the Scandinavians held power for so long and of course exercised a tremendous influence on the language. They gave us kirk for the English church, breeks for breeches, kist for chest, brig for bridge, rig for ridge, loup for leap, ain for own, skirl for shrill. Some of their words survive in Northern English dialects, but many others are only on use in this side of the border. Words like to flit, to host, your graith, your neave and your lug. Because of the economic power and social prestige of the boroughs, the surrounding population had to learn this language if they wanted a piece of the action, which they most certainly did. The result was that by the end of the 14th century, this language was established all over the lowland area, apart from Galloway, and it had replaced Latin as the official language of state. Here's an example of how it sounded in an Act of General Council from 1397.
In the execution of the Wilkes arrests, all barons, Frey Haldans, and all other the king's lieges shall help and support the sheriffs and all other officers of the king's at all their poor, as well again their own men and retinues as again other.
Now, although Scots became the dominant language of the kingdom, the other native language, Gaelic, left its mark, with words describing the landscape, such as ben, glen, strath and loch. Our word for frost, cranrach, for hearth, ingle, and for comely or hearty, sonsy. These are all from Gaelic. The Flemish settlers gave us the name of one of the national sports, gowf, and even the name for the 19th hole, the howf. The old alliance with France was another source that contributed to Scots' increasingly different vocabulary from English. Go into a butcher shop south of the border and ask for Yinnithi Jigget Chops for the Ashet and the Windy, and you'll see one confused butcher. But Jigget from Gigot, a lamb, and Ashet from Assiette, a plate, are common Scots words, as is Dinnafash yourself from Sifashi, Hogmanay, Haggis, Gardilu, Tassie, and Agidhwin other words. With the range and scope of the language expanding all the time, it's no surprising that writers emerged to exploit its potential.
His face fronset, his lyre was like the lead, his teeth chatteret and cheveret with the chin, his een droopet, how sunken in his heed, out of his nose the meldrop fast can rin, with lippes blay and cheekes lang and thin, the ice shockles that frae his hair doon hang, was wonder greet, and is a spear as lang. Atour his belt, his lyart lock is lay, feltered unfair, our fret with frost is hoar. His garmund and his guise foo guy of grey, his widderit weed, frae him the wind out wore. A boustier's bow within his hand he bore. Under his girdle a flash of felon flames, federate with ice and heated with hailstains. Then Jupiter, recht fair and amable, god of the starnes in the firmament, and nourished to all thing generable, frae his father Saturn far different, with boorly face and brow is bricht and brent, upon his head a garland wonder guy, of floor is fair as it had been in May.
Right at the centre of the kingdom in the 15th century was Fife, and in Dunfermline, the schoolmaster Robert Henderson was among the greatest exponents of Scots in poetry. That was an extract from his poem The Testament of Cresset, based on the classical legend of Troilus and Cressida. The characteristic dialects of Fife today are directly descended from the language that Henderson put to such good use. Changes may have occurred in the language over the intervening 500 years, but the weather has aye been a talking point. John Doig from Cellar Dyke in the East Newark.
This is a place you escape a lot of weather again. My father used to say, East Newark lies in a bicht. Yeah. It means you can come round, he says, an awful lot of times, one goes right across. And I've seen that myself. I've seen often come into Aberdeen, say you've been along there with your fish, say it was your weekend at home or anything of that kind. Leaving Aberdeen, I get a long wind, and when you come round Fife Ness there, it's like she was in different weather. So many spoke alongside the day I came to a drone when they spoke. You can, what I mean, different by here or there, you know, in Kingdom, they come for some minutes. I can't explain that, right? You can, I mean, a different like kind of voice. But here in Creil, no, they seem to be the same tongue like we're in.
What about Cellar Dyke itself? What is it like new compared to where it used to be, living here?
Well, the folks are a little better off now. The folks are at the fishing. When we was all young, you can, it was just... We was what you call dragged up. You can't what I mean? Our mothers didn't hate to give. You can't what I mean? No, they were healthy, but you can't. There's no money to make at that time. Toys in the herd. I've gone to the butchers a few times, ask for a bin for the mock soup. Well, when they're at the tortoise, they would hate tortoise for the fields. Well, when I was at the scale, as you would say, you knew when kid when you what you was getting to your dinner. It was kale and soup. Kale and soup. You see, that was the hill day, and their name maybe a dumpling noon again, you know, thing of that kind.
Inland a bit in the Fermin lands of the Howe of Fife bides Eck Harley for Cooper. It's no just a change for fishing to Fermin.
The tongues is different. Is that the East of Fife? It was a good bit different. I was with a foreman out there in the morning. Bloody, he was East of Fife and he used to roar in the bottom door at Yoken time. Well, way to go again, son. That's what. You see, you had a lot of that. But my mother's folk come from the Tapeworth side up here. My father's folk again. Well, my father, his first 17 years, his life was at Markinch there. And then there were a lot of the, he was one of 13, there were a lot of them brothers get to the coal pit. And Munkle Sunday, his oldest brother, was looking after the pit ponies in the Lindsay pit. These folk I never saw in my life, but I just heard of it. Because we was up here and there were no motor cars and they days to get about.
In the Miners' Institute at Lahore, the West Fife tongue is spoken over the clatter of dominoes chapping in the background. It evolved in an industrial environment, but it took a wheen words for the old agricultural days afore the pits.
Loused, and that was you finished. We're about loused. We're about finished.
Did you ever use the expression yoke to get yoke for getting stirred?
That's it.
And was that on in today with the fact there was horses doing the pit?
Well, it could be, as you say, because a pony had to get yoke to get started.
Aye.
And that could originate here, but I never heard it that way, but that could have been.
Today we call what the Fifers speak and what Henderson wrote Scots, but it was only really in the 15th century that people started thinking of Scots as a separate language from English. Derek McClure of Aberdeen University explains.
When Scotland was an independent state, of course Scots was an autonomous language. The odd thing is that it was only beginning to be thought of as a language. In the early Middle Ages, it was called Ingots.
Mm-hmm.
People in Scotland called their Scots, people who didn't speak Gaelic, that is, of course, called the Lowland tongue Ingles, which is just the medieval Scots form of the word English. But about the time that Scotland was approaching the imminent loss of its independence politically, oddly enough, it was then that people began to be aware of the fact that they were speaking Scots, and they called it Scots, and they began thinking of it as a national language.
The long hostility between Scotland and England had, of course, been fired by endless wars, so although Scots and English people could read each other's language with comparative ease, the things they said in print about each other were often of a nature that wouldn't encourage further reading. Here, the Scottish author of The Complaint of Scotland, written in 1549, is decidedly anti-English.
There is noch twa nations under the firmament that are mair contrar and different frae others, nor as Englishmen and Scottishmen, who be it that they be within ain isle and nechtbers and of ain language. For Englishmen are subtle, and Scottishmen are facile. Englishmen are ambitious in prosperity, and Scottishmen are human in prosperity. Englishmen are humble when they are subjected by force and violence, and Scottishmen are furious when they are violently subjected. Englishmen are cruel when they get victory, and Scottish men are merciful when they get victory. And to conclude, it is unpossible that Scottish men and Englishmen can remain in concord under ain monarch or ain prince, because their natures and conditions are as indifferent as is the nature of sheep and wolves.
Now, although the author of the complaint is anti-English, he refers to England and Scotland as sharing one language. Because they're from the same linguistic roots, they can be seen as dialects of the same language. But politics, not linguistics, often determines whether someone's speech is defined as a dialect or a language. By the end of the 15th century, the Scottish people began to differentiate their tongue from that of England and began calling it Scots instead of English. The two languages were very different by that time, but the main force behind the gradual change of name was political. For Derek McClure, the situation isn't unique to the Scots-English debate, past or present.
Scots is not a national language in the sense that it has not got official recognition. It's not the language of any government. It's not the language of any broadcasting system. It has no official status. To that extent, it's not a language in the sense that Norwegian or Dutch is a language. On the other hand, it's distinctive enough from English to be classifiable as a language by virtue of that distinctiveness. It is less like English than Danish is like Norwegian. From what I gather, Danish and Norwegian are more similar to each other than Scots to English, and there are other cases like Flemish and Dutch or Czech and Slovak where you have two different speech forms which are classed as different languages, not so much because they are grossly different from each other, but because they're spoken in different countries. Danish and Norwegian are spoken under different flags, but if they were spoken in the same politically unified territory, then presumably they would be classed as dialects of the same language. Scots also has a literature, it has a very long, distinguished literary tradition, which is one of the things that sometimes is taken as a definition of a language. So by some criteria, Scots is a language. By some criteria, it would not be classed as one. And a very important fact also is that it's not generally regarded as a language. The Scots-speaking population, most of the people who speak it, have the idea that they're not speaking a real language, they're speaking a form of English. This is a mistaken idea. They think they're speaking a mangled or corrupt form of English, which historically, of course, Scots is not. But it is not supported by the attitude of its speakers that it is a language. Its speakers generally don't think of it as one.
If you went for an interview for a job, aye, and you started speaking your ordinary tongue to your prospective employer, you get flung out. Again, so you have to try and speak proper English.
The Lahore man's attitude that only English is proper is hardly surprising, considering the wrong-headed attitude to Scots by the Scottish establishment. Its condemnation of native speech forms in education and its inexcusable neglect of Scottish literature in the schools means inevitably that the majority of Scots speakers nowadays are ignorant about their language's status and pedigree. In the heyday of the language, there was little sign of linguistic nationalism because there was no need for it. Everybody from the king down spoke it and all the records and laws were written in it. In James V, John the Commonweal, or the Common Man, had a king whom legend has it travelled the land as a gaberlunye man, or beggar, to see how his subjects lived. The folk tradition is backed up by historians of the day.
If his claithes was onything ornate, he studied never to follow the fashion of the court or bravity of women. Frae pride, he was far, and so far, that whatever he saw given to this vice, he was aye in their contrary, and I offended with him. He was a maintainer of justice, an executor of the laws, a defender of the innocent and the poor. Wherethrough he was named commonly by his special nobility, the poor man's king. For the poor oppressed with the potent he helped aye, and the potent, not sparing the indigence of the poor and needy, he overthrew, and that with great severity. Although in this severity might I be seen in him a marvellous benignity, hui, but not out, albeit he micht the life of offenders, but sparing their life, either put them in prison, or took a sum of money frae them, that way punishing them.
Now a beggin' man came our yon lee, with money greens and good days to me. Says the funny up charity, will you lodge a beggin' man? For the night was cold and the cow was wet, and in a yawn the ingle he sat. He threw the mail poke up on his back, and I as he ranted and sang, now if I were as black as I am white, as the snow that lies on yonder bike, I'd dress myself some bigger like, a wall with you I gang, Lalty to do thee. O lassie, oh lassie, your father was young, you hear the cant of the beggin' tongue, you hear the cant of the beggin' tongue, when me ye canny gang, Lalty to do thee. Was then that they twa made up the plot, to rise 4 hours before the old folk. Sae cannily they slept the lock, and through the fields they ran, Lalty to do thee. O Faiga ride, O Faiga rin, and haste ye find the traitors again. For she'll be brunt, and he'll be slain, the weariful bag of man, Lalty to do thee. And meanwhile, far out our young lee, who's snug in a glen her name could see, the twa were muckle, spot and glee, for you chase cut a whang, Lalty to do thee. Oh, a beggar, I'll ne'er lodge again, I had a doctor but in my een, a war wi a beggar man she's gain, but then he ken whence not where, Lalty to do thee. Oh, yonder she's coming, tae ye her bower, in silks and satins wi monies a fleur. She held up her hand, she's blessed the hour, she followed the beggar man, Lalty to do thee, Lalty to do thee, Lalty to do thee, Lalty to do thee.
The dialects spoken in East Central Scotland today in places like Fife aren't so far removed from the Scots of the 16th century. Jack Aitken.
By the end of the 16th century, there aren't many great differences in pronunciation between the Scots of that time and modern Scots. All the main sound changes, including the one which produces this very characteristic vowel length effect, which is peculiarly Scots, these had all been established by then. There was one or two sound changes still to come, but it wasn't that different. In fact, a 16th century Fifeshire man would have sounded pretty like a present-day Angus man, because Angus dialect is a bit more conservative than Fifeshire dialect.
Although I speak in what you could cry South Angus tongue, it is mutually intelligible. Yon tongue is mutually intelligible to anybody that speaks in any particular dialect of Scotch. It's the whole thing is anybody for any bit of Scotland can understand anybody else.
Gavin Sprott demonstrating that the Angus tongue is alive and kicking. But the links between past and present can be heard in the words of the Fife miners today. Earlier I mentioned the languages that influenced Scots. Well, they're all represented in the Scots of the miners. The cleek, or hook, attached to the hutches is from Old English. The rance, a prop, is from French. Thread up is from Flemish. And your snibble, for stoping the hutches, and your graith, or equipment, come into Scots from Norse. Tom Crothers.
Your graith, pick, shovel, a saw, if you were rich enough to buy a saw, and a mash, or a mash axe, would be like blunt on one side for hammering and sharpened at the other side if you were chipping at trees or anything like that. The shovel, I mean, was your main instrument, you know. But the pick, odd, again, the front of the face, I mean, you would take down loose coal, you know, it wouldn't again, until you got it hard. And then that shovel, you would take the gum out below the coal, and then a shot fire blew that down, and then you filled it and then secured it.
The click hunter, he was a gaffer appointed by the coal company, you see. And he was there, his sole purpose was to see the hutches got sent in to the men at the face. Aye. So, and there were a quick return.
I heard another expression used by a snibble.
It was a worky art, a snibbler. A snibbler.
Aye.
It was a worky art. It was usually a young boy first starting in the pit, or very shortly in the pit. And the tubs would come belting out to the pit bottom, very often in a decline, a wee bit of a bray, you see. Aye. And this boy could stand 4 feet away and get this...
Poor man.
Throw them in. Right away. At the bogey wheels. And stop it.
What was it crying again?
A snibble.
A snibble.
But the usual snibble was made of iron. And if you were shoving the tub and you were going down an incline, it was going too hard, you put this in the scrub. And depending on the incline, you maybe use one or two snibbles.
Aye.
If the incline was steep, just you maybe use two.
Steady them down the grade so they wouldn't run away.
See, you'd how to the coal. What did you do then, when you were ready to, when it was lousing time, you were ready to get home?
You had to clean your own ground.
Red up really means to clean up. Everything ready for the next shift coming on.
I see.
Red up your place. If a man was stripping coal, he usually read up his place before he went home.
Aye.
You see?
Aye.
Ready for the next shift coming on.
Was that a word you'd only used doing the fit, or would you use that in the house?
You use it here even. We're talking here about snibbles for a wee while there. I use it sometimes when I'm playing cards here in the old man's settler. I say, I've got you snibbled.
Aye.
And the boys really care what I was meaning.
Aye.
I got him stopped.
It's surely ironic that words borrowed from the major tongues of Europe can be regarded by some as uncouth just because they're part of the Scots language. Although Scots speakers may not know the exact nature of their tongue's history, they're all aware of the forces against it. Where it's just the change in the way of life that renders mining terms obsolete to non-miners, it's accepted as a natural process. But Scots speakers are also aware that the tongue is being eroded because of the establishment's traditional refusal to recognise its worth. Having a feel for what is literally their mother tongue, this is the force that's resented, a resentment tempered with what most people feel is the inevitability of the process.
We use them in here regular, in a place like this, but the younger generation didn't care what you're talking about, you see.
Aye.
The pits that were all here, there were a pit in every village here at one time, and they're not in now.
Aye.
See? So it's grown out. Aye. I've seen me using words like that to my grandchildren.
Aye.
And they're saying, and look at you, oh, you're an old square or something like that, they'll say, you
aye.
See? They haven't a clue. Just like the Gaelic. The Gaelic's the very same, you know. We'd all like to see Gaelic prosper and all the rest of that, but I do, it's a lost cause. That's my opinion anyway. Just the same as the things you talk about in the past. It's going to fade out.
And what about the likes of, say, your grand Wains, although they don't have their expressions that were today with a pit, what do they speak nowadays? Do they still speak fife?
No. I wouldn't say so. In a small scale, you can, but they're mere Anglified, if you'd like to put it that way. And this gets up my back anyway. You know, when you hear them saying some of the English expressions.
Aye.
Being Scottish, you sort of rue it. You didn't like to hear them say that. But that's the way life.